Hi, this is Tony from Eco Cover Magazine. I'm speaking to Donald Dinney, director at Norton Rose Fulbright. Donald, thank you very much for talking to me.
Hello, it's a pleasure to chat to you.
Donald, we're talking this morning on the law on precautions, and you sent me a very interesting case regarding a factory fire, which was seemingly set by an arsonist, and then looking at the onus on the owner or the person running the factory to take reasonable precautions to prevent this type of loss. So maybe you can just give us a little bit of a rundown on the facts of the case and then why there was actually a dispute here.
This is an interesting one because it was a Supreme Court of Appeal matter, and it's unusual for these type of cases, and particularly those dealing with breach of precautions clauses, to get that far in terms of the judicial process. But it was in part a missed opportunity because, strangely, we've got a series of judgments around the country in various provinces dating back into the early 70s, opining on reasonable precaution clauses, but with different outcomes. So there's some judgments that say, well, to allow the reasonable precaution clause, the insurer need only establish negligence, and others say recklessness. And you would have thought that our courts by now actually would have resolved this question, but they haven't. So we're sitting rather strangely in the position where you've got a fairly commonly relied upon clause that wouldn't be authoritatively determined. In the matter that you refer to, there was a fire at an industrial premises, I think it was a print workshop, and there were two defences raised by the insurer and also taken on appeal. The one was reliant on the fraud clause, and in the alternative, they relied on the reasonable precautions clause. The meal immediately sense there's a bit of inherent contradiction there, because on the one hand, they said, well, the owner was responsible for the arson and it had, by way of a delayed timing device, set the fire, and therefore they weren't going to pay. And on the other hand, they said, well, the alternative factual premise was that there was a fire ignited manually by an unknown arsonist who didn't have any connection with the insured, that the insured in this context was at fault by not taking reasonable precautions to prevent the arsonist from starting the fire. So, particularly on the facts. On the facts, the court said, well, the arson hadn't been proved, so that failed. Then they said, okay, let's go and have a look at this alternative defense, but allied to this contradiction. And they looked at the review of these cases, and in particular, there's the Suntem Limited and CC Designing case where the court said, this is the one that did say, rely on the reasonable precautions clause, the insurer needs to prove recklessness rather than negligence. And there was a bit of a debate in this particular case as to what is the threshold, and the insurer said, well, in fact, the threshold is too high, the bar is set too high, you shouldn't actually be requiring recklessness on the part of the insured. Negligence is more than sufficient.
Yes.
Our law is influenced a lot by the English law, because obviously our commercial business and insurance is very similar and really has its history in the roots of English insurance law and insurance common law as well. So if you look at those judgments which have persuasive influence but obviously aren't binding on our courts, and what have those judgments said? And those judgments tend to follow the line that, well, recklessness is required. There's a case, Willful and Rimmer, for example. There was a building contractor. They appointed a foreman to carry out certain tasks. The foreman is negligent in injuring an employee. And obviously, there was a claim and alarm from the reasonable precautions clause saying, well, your foreman and you hadn't taken reasonable precautions. and the sought to avoid liability on that quote. Now, of course, you've got to distinguish between what might be sufficient to establish liability on the part of the insured in respect of the third party. Clearly here, the foreman is negligent. An employer is vicariously liable for the conduct of the employee. Is going to be liability. But then what is actually required as between the insured and insurer in terms of reasonable cautions, and those are not necessarily the same test. On this particular case, while the foreman is negligent, the court said, well, in fact, the insured hadn't been negligent when it employed the foreman because the foreman was suitably qualified to carry out a particular task, and that was sufficient. What the insurer doesn't do is warrant guarantee that it delegates the duties of reasonable care under the policy to its employees. And the court they said, for example, to quote it, it's not right, in my opinion, to say that he had delegated to another the duty which he owes to insuring. I think that it's in its nature, this is a duty which it can't delegate.
So, basically, if we, from my understanding, if we look at different cases in terms of the same scenario, it would be very important to see, first of all, what would the reasonable precautions have been, but then also to look at, in the particular circumstances, would the people involved have been reasonably expected to be able to ensure those precautions are taken.
Correct. It very much is the obligation that on the management and the direct mind of the insured rather than its employees, and that's ultimately usually what the courts do say. But I can't emphasize enough on the distinction between the inquiry as to what is actually reasonable. And reasonable means not as what is reasonable between the insured and the third party, but what is reasonable between the insured and the insurer having regard to the commercial purposes of the contract. So it's very important in that context, look at to say, well, what is the policy indemnifying against and what is the purpose of the policy there to actually do and protect against. So a lot of the English judges say, well, if you're looking at the commercial purpose of the policies in these particular contexts, they're there to indemnify and insured against liability for their own negligence. So therefore, it would be absurd to say, well, you provide an indemnity for negligence, but if you negligently don't take reasonable steps, then you exclude it from the cover, you give it one hand and take away with the other, which would obviously be equivalent to the intention of the policy. And so it's an easy test and probably an easy inquiry when you're looking at liability policies, because they're obviously the primary exposure for the insured in that context of their parties, if negligence or negligence of its employees, and that's when you want the policy to respond. You can't very well on the actual test of liability say, well, you were negligent, created liability to the third party, but on the very basis of that, you didn't take reasonable precautions, so the policy actually doesn't.
So if I look at the bottom line for insurers, it's probably that, you know, during the underwriting stage you have to take into account if you will be able to rely on that clause of reasonable precautions.
Well, you do it exactly there, you know, as it's long memories of grey hairs will remember it from good old Marty Mark Sweday. It's been there for time immemorial. I think what's the general wording of that clause? I think it's on the basis of the insurance shall take all reasonable steps and precautions to prevent accidents or losses, and the various variations of that. But as you're quite right in point out, you've got to say underwriting stage or what you actually expect of the insured in that particular context, and it very much should be foremost at underwriting time. Because in the course in the context of the commercial purpose, and if you're providing liability cover under liability policy, they said, well, the real question in interpreting that clause is, they'll say it's not repugnant to the commercial purpose of the contract, the requirement is really that the insured shouldn't deliberately cause a danger, the existence of which the insured recognizes and then deliberately refrains from taking measures to protect against.
Yeah.
What the insurer really wants in this context is to act for the insurer to act reasonably. There's a good example from another English judgment which dealt with an employee who was a window cleaner, fell out of the building and severely injured. Of course, he wasn't wearing a harness at the time. The insurer sought to rely on the reasonable precautions clause there. The evidence was that the employer did provide safety belts to general use to employees, and they were aware that the safety belts were available for the use. But of course, at the time of this accident, the employee didn't have a safety belt, and the facts were that having regard to a particular job, he actually couldn't use the safety belt. The court had a look at the reasonable precautions clause, and it just summarizes maybe what you touched on as well, and the need to consider the underwriting and the purpose of the clause is really what the clause is saying is we will insure you against the consequences of your negligence, but you understand that we do so on the footing that you are not to regard yourself as free to carry on your business in a reckless manner. You must take reasonable precautions to prevent accidents, which ordinary business people would take in running businesses in the ordinary way and not in a way which invites accidents. And that very much talks to the question of how you underwrite it as well.
Very interesting. Donald, thank you very much for those insights. It was great talking to you. And I think it is very interesting how these things develop over the years and provides more insights. So thank you very much for that.
My pleasure.